morning, Council. And at this point, we are going to call up docket number 50336, Greg Chalvers, State of Nevada. And Council, what I had requested with our first argument, I'm not sure you were here, I was going to give you an opportunity for the sake of these young people to present just a brief factual background for your case. Ordinarily, we've read the briefs and we don't require you to give us the factual background. We know that. But for their benefit, if you'd offer a little bit of that for us today. And then just briefly, you know, the significant issues that you're going to address. As you may notice, Justice Seda is not with us on this case. She's disqualified in this case because I believe she was the trial judge. And so in order not to, we don't have her participate in any of the deliberations, anything that would affect our determination of the case. So that's why she's not here. So, Ms. Dickinson, if you'd like to proceed. Then I'll give you an opportunity, if you've got a different version of the facts, perhaps you can respond.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Dickinson and I represent Greg Chow. The facts of this case have to do with the murder that occurred in Las Vegas in 1997. A man by the name of Don Idens was found, his body was found in a fire stairwell at the balcony of the Imperial Palace. Mr. Chow was eventually arrested, extradited from Canada, and brought to Las Vegas where he stood trial not once, but twice. The first trial was a hung jury, and the second trial resulted in his appeal. His conviction was for murder with a deadly weapon and robbery with a deadly weapon. One of the questions that this court has to address today, decide, is whether the state of Nevada wants its police officers to travel to other countries and violate international treaties, all in the name of obtaining evidence to be used against a defendant in a criminal trial in Nevada. Because that's exactly what happened here. In this case, when two Metro detectives decided they wanted to interrogate Greg Chow as to the murder of Don Idens, Greg was in Canada. He was living in the suburbs of Vancouver in British Columbia, Canada at the time. Rather than following the procedures under the treaty between the United States and Canada, the MLAT, Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty, these two detectives decided to take the law in their own hands. So instead of filing a written request through the government and asking to be able to question Mr. Chow, they instead decided to do it with a phone call. The Metro detectives called up Mr. Chow's Canadian parole officer and asked him if he would go ahead and put together a somewhat fictitious parole violation, all in the name of being able to get Greg Chow arrested in Canada and allowing them to fly up and interview him or interrogate him without Greg knowing why he was being held. That's what happened here. Greg was arrested. He was held in Surrey detainee, and on January 3rd, 1997, the two Metro officers arrived there. They had him pulled out of his jail cell, taken to a small room where they proceeded to interrogate him. Greg didn't know why they were there, know anything, because everything was done in secret. When they began questioning him, Greg asked to be able to have an attorney. And according to Greg's testimony, they said, you don't need an attorney in Canada, you need an attorney in Nevada. Attorney in Canada is not going to do you any good. And they also said to him, you know, you may end up being the first Chinaman executed in the state of Nevada. Well, Greg Chow quickly terminated their interrogation, but it wasn't before he made two statements that were later used against him in his criminal trial in Nevada and in extradition proceedings in Canada. What he said was he admitted that he had been in Las Vegas from December 1st until December 9th of 1997, and he also admitted that he had met Don Idens while he was here. After the officers, the detectives, had interrogated him, they came back to Las Vegas, and now they decided to follow the MLAT. They did their written affidavits. They sent the paperwork to the Attorney General's office, and Madam Albright, Secretary of State at the time, signed the documents requesting Canada to send Greg to Nevada. But Nevada was seeking the death penalty. What happened next was it took many years before Greg ended up coming to Nevada, and those statements he made to those two detectives were being contested. When he went to his extradition hearing in British Columbia, the Supreme Court of British Columbia, he argued several things, one of which was, you can't use those statements I made because they were obtained involuntarily, and they were obtained in violation of the treaty. Moreover, he argued, I object to the death penalty. Now, ultimately, the judge in Canada agreed that the statements could not be used against him and found them to be not voluntary. But the judge didn't do so before Greg had testified. And when Greg testified about those statements, the judge allowed the prosecutor, the Canadian prosecutor who represented the United States, to question Greg not only about those statements to the Metro detectives, but about all other kinds of issues involved in this murder case. How many pieces of luggage he had while he was in Las Vegas, when he left, when he came back to Canada, what he did while he was in Las Vegas. What ended up happening with those statements is all of the statements ended up in his criminal trial in Nevada. Now, ultimately, Nevada...
Just for clarification, Ms. Dickinson, the Canadian judge's ruling that the first two statements made by your client Metro detectives was violative of the treaty. The judge didn't rule that they violated any other constitutional right or any other Canadian right of Mr. Chow, did he?
I never received the exact document saying what his full holding was. I only received the statements from the prosecutor, La Prairie, who said that it was found involuntary. However, in reading through the transcript, it does indicate that Canada has a charter which is very similar to ours, where the defendants in Canada have to be given like Miranda rights or a right to an attorney.
Even assuming a violation, there's no private right to enforce, is there?
I would argue that there is.
Where do you see that and where do you find that? And isn't most of the courts who have addressed it find contrary to that?
Well, to begin with, the treaty, which was enacted between the United States and Canada, the government only acts on behalf of its people. So when Canada signed the treaty with the United States in 1985, it was acting on behalf of Greg Chow. But also, the Supreme Court recently has recognized the fact that private citizens can invoke rights under the treaty, and in that case, they determined that if a treaty is self-executing, then a private citizen can go ahead and invoke it. And in this case, the circuit courts, at least one of the circuit courts, has held that the MLAT between the United States and Canada is self-executing. So in view of that, Greg Chow has a right to invoke it here in his state case in Nevada. Moreover, there has been a suggestion that by many scholars that the Supremacy Clause under the United States Constitution allows a private citizen or a person who is not a citizen of the United States to invoke the Supremacy Clause when they are being prosecuted in a court in the United States, such as Nevada. So those are some of the reasons why he should be allowed to invoke the protections of this treaty. Now, I realize that one section of the treaty suggests that no one can do a motion to suppress. However, I interpret that to mean that if the United States asks Canada to obtain some documents, no one can file a challenge in Canada to that request.
I think you're getting into legal argument. We really just want, we're still...
No. She's on the clock now.
Oh, the clock's on, okay. We don't have a clock in front of us. Go ahead.
Okay.
Well, just to clarify then, you're not arguing that, apparently it is unclear what the basis was of the Canadian judge's ruling when he said or she said that the client's statements were involuntary.
That's correct. However, I do know that one of the things that he did say is that he had to rely solely on the affidavits from the detectives because the Crown did not bring the detectives up to testify. So based on their affidavits and then on Mr. Chow's testimony, he made that determination and excluded that evidence when deciding the extradition. However, all that evidence came into his criminal trial. Here.
Well, I'm assuming that the trial judge here concluded that the statements made were voluntary and were admissible.
She did so based on just the argument behind counsel. There was no evidentiary hearing with regard to that. She not only let in those two statements and let the police officers testify to that, she let the state bring in Canadian prosecutor La Prairie to come in and testify to the questions and answers at the extradition hearing that had absolutely nothing to do with these two statements, but had to do with basically his investigation during the extradition hearing as to what Mr. Chow was doing.
Well, you're not suggesting that a Canadian judge's decision about the voluntariness of a Canadian citizen's statements is binding on a Nevada trial judge in a criminal case, are you?
No, I'm not. I know that it's not, okay?
Yeah. I guess, Ms. Dickens, I guess my concern in the interest of time here is that it seemed like there was an awful lot of evidence against Mr. Chow, assuming there was error here on the confession issue. I mean, Mr. Ryan said he was going to collect his debt. You know, he made that statement to a third party. He had Mr. Chow's blood, I believe, was found, or Mr. Ryan's blood, was found in Mr. Chow's room. Mr. Chow went down to the hotel clerk and tried to change his name on the registration after the murder took place, which would show some consciousness of guilt. And all. Why isn't the evidence just overwhelming against him that if there were an error, we could conclude beyond a reasonable doubt that there's still sufficient evidence to sustain the murder conviction?
Well, the evidence is not overwhelming for several reasons. The state was not able to connect all the dots to Mr. Chow. Instead, they had to use his testimony from the extradition hearing, where he was basically fighting to save having to come here and face the death penalty. And he should be able to exercise that right in Canada to argue against the death penalty. Here, the dots they didn't have is they didn't know what happened to the luggage. They did not know if anybody else had used the room. They did not know what he had been doing while he was here. Now, it's true they had some videos, but they were not able to find all the videos as to when Mr. Chow was going towards his room, because we don't have any video of him going in the room. We just have him taking an elevator, or when he was leaving. We don't have video of him actually going out the door, but just seeing him in different directions. So the state was not able to connect all the dots. Moreover, they didn't know when Mr. Idens had been killed or when he had died. They used one theory in their first trial. They used another in their second trial. They used a third during their appeal. And if you look closely at the second trial, they actually used two different manners and times of death at the same time, one in their closing and a different in the rebuttal. So no, the state did not have overwhelming evidence. They had some blood, a little. They had a little blood in the room. But someone else had used that room after Mr. Chow had left. And the only investigation the police did is they called them on the phone and asked, you know, what happened. And they did not really do a thorough investigation in that area. And that was part of the theory of the defense, is that but for that, Mr. Chow would not have been convicted. Moreover, Mr. Chow's blood was not found in the room. The body, Don Iden's body, was totally devoid of blood. They couldn't explain that. They didn't know where it was. It was not in the hallways. It was not in the stairwell. It was not in Mr. Chow's room. There was some blood, but not that much. In fact, they referred to it as specks at times.
Could you address and this is a change of subject, the nay instruction issue and afterthought?
With regard to the jury instructions for murder and for robbery, as we all know, that an afterthought robbery cannot be a predicate for the first-degree murder charge. Now, the defense had offered some alternate jury instructions, which would have precluded the jury from finding that, which were not given. However, if you notice in the closing, the state admits that as far as the clothes, they know that Mr. Iden's clothes were not stolen in a robbery, that he had his clothes on when he was hit in the head, and that more than likely the clothes were taken just to get rid of the blood. As to the money, the state never established that he had any money. Money was left on the poker table when he received the call and went to, we're guessing, the Imperial Palace, and there was never any other money found. So based on that, the state failed to establish that he had any money, that he was robbed for that money that he never had, or that his clothes were taken, and that was their theory of the case. So for that reason, the afterthought robbery jury instruction was very important. I think I have 2 minutes left.
Well, talk to us about cumulative error then. Gibbons is right that that some of this error is harmless. Is any of it cumulative enough to set aside this conviction of murder?
I think all of it is, especially all the statements that came in from LaPierre in the extradition hearing. I think those were very damaging. There was not only that problem with the jury instruction, there were other problems with evidence that was lost, the bloody gloves. The police did not handle the bloody gloves in a manner that they could later be testified. Initially, the testing was it was a human male. Later on, they tried to claim, at least the prosecutors, that they didn't know. We couldn't test it. Nobody could test it. Yet there is a correlation between those bloody gloves and the death of Mr. Iden's. We just don't know because they lost that evidence. They also didn't test the DNA on the carpet properly. It wasn't until the defense came in and got their own experts in that they were able to find that somebody else's blood was found in Donna and Mr. Chow's room. Wasn't Mr. Chow, and we don't know whose it was today. I think I have a minute left.
Let me ask you one question, and I didn't ask you if you wanted to reserve time, so I'm going to give you an additional 2 minutes because I'm going to chew up a little bit of your time.
Okay.
You keep going back to the extradition testimony, and you're essentially in your briefing, you try to equate that with NRS 47090 and then the Simmons case.
Correct.
Tell me how you reconcile that with the extradition hearing being essentially a quasi-civil matter and those being limited to preliminary hearings.
Well, I think
how
that...
How do we reconcile that?
I reconcile it two ways. First, under the Constitution and under all the cases from the U.S. Supreme Court, we recognize that a defendant has a right to go in and challenge evidence that has been obtained illegally. And he doesn't give up that right to make that challenge and testify. He doesn't give up his right against self-incrimination when he does that.
But where's the constitutional protection in this Canadian proceeding that is quasi-civil in nature?
I think the constitutional protection you can see in the treaty. Under the treaty, the United States and Canada agree to abide by each other's laws, which means that when they're obtaining evidence, they agree to follow the laws of the United States and Canada. So under that, I believe that the Simmons case does apply because this is a pretrial hearing to not only exclude evidence, it was regarding the violation of the MLAT and also against death penalty. And in Nevada, the legislator has enacted NRS 47.090 to specifically allow a defendant to challenge statements to challenge his statements that are obtained illegally, challenge evidence that's obtained illegally in pretrial hearings, and then for that to be precluded at trial. So I think that the state of Nevada has taken a stance on this, and even though it is quasi-criminal, it would still apply because the evidence had to do with the Nevada trial.
Do you have any cases that say a violation of MLAT should result in a reversal of the conviction?
No, I don't, but I have the California Jasper case where the prosecutor went in and argued with regard to the extradition hearing that had occurred overseas that the defendant had remained silent and it was an adoptive admission, and the California courts reversed and said you cannot bring in these alleged violations into the criminal case.
Colleagues, any other questions? All right, thank you, and I am going to allow you 2 minutes.
Yes, thank you.
In the rebuttal. Okay, counsel, are you ready?
Good morning. My name is Pam Wefferly. I work at the Clark County Office of the District Attorney. I'd like to comment on one aspect of the case that defense counsel mentioned, and she said this was a case where the state had to connect some dots. And certainly it was a case where it was a matter of circumstantial evidence, because it wasn't a case where we'd have an eyewitness to the crime. But there were a lot of dots in this case. As the court's aware, or as the court mentioned, the blood of the victim was found in the hotel room belonging to the defendant. The defendant and the victim are seen on videotape going up to the hotel room at different times and exiting the hotel room, but there's a portion of time where they're both clearly in the hotel room, nowhere else in the casino, at the same time. After that period of time, Mr. Chow's seen leaving the hotel room wearing different clothing, where he goes back to a different hotel, and guess what he does? He's able to buy in at the Mirage and gamble with a substantial amount of money. After the crime took place, of course, on the 9th of December, when Mr. Chow checked out of the hotel, he went to great efforts to erase any connection of his name to the records of the hotel, and then he went up to Canada and fled the country, or he lived there, but he changed some of his flight scheduling. He goes back up to Canada, and at that point, Metro starts investigating the crime. They discover the body on the 9th of September, on the 9th of December, and eventually they learn by noticing the blood evidence in the hotel room that there's blood in Mr. Chow's hotel room, and this is about the 22nd of December. So they start developing Greg Chow as a suspect. They learn about his measures to distance himself in the hotel room. They're not able to locate him in Canada until the 1st of January of 1998.
Well, let me just ask, are you going to concede that there's violations of MLAT or not?
No.
I didn't think
not
so.
Not surprisingly, I'm not. As I'm sure you're aware, the defense never moved to suppress the defendant's statements to the Metro detectives at any time pre-trial or even during the trial. The only time they've moved to suppress is in front of your honors with the Mutual Legal Assistance Treaty. That treaty doesn't confer a constitutional right on any individuals. The complaint seems to be by the defense that, well, the detectives from Metro, they didn't notify a Canadian official that they were coming to interview Greg Chow. Of course, as you've discussed, the treaty doesn't require that, but certainly that's not a U.S. constitutional violation. So for it to be brought up at this procedural point, it would have to be a procedural violation for the court to consider it.
You've been a DA for a long time.
Yes.
Is it unusual for Metro detectives to go to another state or another country if they have a subject that they want to extradite?
Not at all. And if I could just correct my interpretation of the record, Justice Hardesty mentioned that the Canadian judge ruled that there was a violation of this treaty. My reading of the record is that the treaty wasn't utilized. And that distinction, I think, is important because Section 2 of the treaty talks about this, that the treaty itself isn't the sole means of communication between law enforcement agencies in Canada and in the United States. And in fact, there are cases from the Second Circuit where the DEA goes to another country to obtain information, not in connection with a mutual legal assistance treaty request. If you make a request under the treaty, of course you're bound by it. But if you go outside the treaty, as the treaty provides, obviously it doesn't apply. And certainly, as the courts discussed, Article 3 of the treaty itself plainly says that it does not confer any individual rights on criminal defendants. And this, of course, has been litigated and brought up in other courts, and it's affirmed by the Second Circuit that there are no individual rights under that treaty. It's been affirmed in the Ninth Circuit that there's no individual treaty rights, and the Eleventh Circuit and some state courts as well. So essentially what you have is this claim that was brought up, but it's not supported by the treaty itself, and it's not a constitutional violation, so the court should not consider it. in that regard as well. Now, the outrageous conduct alluded to by defense counsel, I certainly take issue with. What the detectives in this case did is once Chow was developed as a suspect, they contact the Canadian officials and ask them if they know anything about Greg Chow, and they learn that he happens to be on parole out of Canada for extortion and kidnapping, the basis of which, not surprisingly, was some gambling debts he's had up in Canada. So the Metro detectives request to be notified once he's taken into custody on his parole violation in Canada. That's on the 22nd of December. Ultimately, the Canadian officials find him, and as I said, he was taken into custody at night on the 1st of January. They notify Metro the next day on the 2nd of January. Metro flies up and interviews him on the 3rd. When the Metro detectives make contact with Greg Chow, they inform him of his Miranda rights. He waives them, has a short conversation with them, and then he invokes his right to an attorney. The interview ends after that. The interview is about 2 minutes in length. The testimony or the commentary that defense counsel alluded to about Greg Chow's interactions with the Metro detectives where a racial slur was used, that was testimony that he gave at his extradition hearing. It wasn't testimony that was ever received in the criminal trial down here in Nevada. And as I'll get to, I don't think that testimony is necessarily accurate because obviously the record in the trial in this case is disputed as to what was said with regard to the contact with the Metro detectives, which sort of brings me to the topic of the extradition hearing itself. In that hearing, as all the justices are aware, Greg Chow sort of sua sponte in the middle of his extradition hearing decided he wanted to challenge the voluntariness of his statement that he made to the Metro detectives. At that point, the Canadian prosecutor wasn't given any notice of it. Certainly the Metro detectives were not present. And the Canadian judge gave several warnings to Greg Chow that, in fact, this kind of testimony could be used as an out-of-court statement later on in his criminal trial. But Chow chose to go forward. Upon hearing the testimony of Chow, the decision-making of the Canadian judge is really informative on the Simmons issue. The Canadian judge never made a ruling that the statement that Chow gave to the Metro detectives was involuntary. He simply said that the Crown didn't prove the voluntariness of the statement. And that sort of distinction is important when the court gets to the Simmons analysis, because as I think it was Justice Hardesty mentioned a few minutes ago, Simmons only applies in a constitutional setting where one constitutional right cannot be asserted without surrendering another. And the application of Simmons has actually been found by the Ninth Circuit to be quite narrow, as the Ninth Circuit discussed in the Stewart case. You can't merely identify two competing constitutional rights. There has to be an actual conflict. And when Chow was testifying at his extradition hearing in Canada, obviously the court was applying Canadian law. No U.S. rights were at stake. But even beyond that, the Canadian judge had no authority or no ability to suppress or invoke the exclusionary rule and exclude that evidence for purposes of Chow's criminal trial. So no matter what was at stake, it was never his two Fifth Amendment rights, the right to remain silent and the right to a voluntary statement. So that statement was properly admitted in his criminal trial. It was a statement that he made on the advice of counsel, of course, and also a statement that he made after being warned by the court that it might be used in his criminal trial, you know, which was still pending. But I think Justice Gibbons kind of hit the nail on the head when he said even if there was an error in this case, it would have been harmless. There was literally a mountain of evidence, and the only two pieces of information that were solely derived from the extradition hearing was the fact that he didn't take his luggage back with him to Canada, that it somehow disappeared, and that he had sole control of that room. Now, the sole control of the room could probably have been established by the videotape evidence anyway. He was never seen with anyone. He checked in alone. But none of the extradition testimony changed the fact that the blood of the victim was in the room, None of it changed the fact that Donald Idions is seen going to the bank of elevators, which would travel up to Greg Chow's hotel room. None of the Canadian extradition testimony would change that Idions' last comment was, I'm going to go collect money from an Asian guy from Vancouver. It wouldn't change the fact that Greg Chow's clothes are changed after the attack on Idions, or Chow's really desperate attempts to distance himself from that hotel room after the attack took place, or even the fact that when Chow checked out, he had a stack of money as described by the hotel clerk in this case, which were the state's contention was obviously that belonged to Don Idion.
What about the afterthought robbery, though? If this sort of eliminated the chance of Chow being found guilty of second-degree murder because of the felony murder rule?
Well, interestingly, the defense in this case wasn't one of the degree of murder is wrong, or this is a case of a mutual fight or anything like that. The defense in this case was, you have the wrong person, Mr. Chow's not guilty. Now, I understand...
Sodi defense, some other dude did it.
Exactly, yes, you know that one. But in this court has... the Ney decision obviously came out after we did the trial in this case, but I think what's important in this case to realize is in the argument on guilt on the robbery, particularly as to felony murder, we never argued an afterthought robbery. Our theory all along was that this was about money. This whole thing was about money. He owed Idions money. Idions came over there with money. He left the poker table with money. This was clearly a crime that was financially motivated. He had the intent to rob him. It was always our theory before the attack took place. But even beyond that, I believe the court's reasoning in Cortinas is if we can establish a premeditated murder beyond a reasonable doubt as well, then there would be no concern about the afterthought robbery aspect of the case.
Ms. Wecker, what did the verdict form say? Did it have a separate category for murder in the first degree versus felony murder?
It did not. No, it wasn't. There was no special verdict form like that.
Okay.
But if I could just continue briefly, in this case, the victim had a substantial number of injuries. He was found in naked except for his underwear and his socks. So all of his property was gone, whatever it was. Certainly his wallet wasn't present. The beating on him was so significant that one of his ears was almost severed from his head. He had over 10 injuries of some sort of blow, maybe like a pipe to his head. His skull was fractured. His eye socket was fractured. Certainly an argument could easily be made that maybe not the first blow, there wasn't premeditation, but when you've made the decision to hit someone again, 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 and again, and at that strength, that is a case where you have clear premeditation, a clear decision to harm an individual, a clear decision to kill someone, which would be a premeditated murder in this case. Ms. Dickinson alluded to a few other issues in the case, which I'd like to touch on just briefly. She mentioned some bloody gloves that were sort of a side issue in the trial, to be honest. The murder of the victim took place in one tower at another end of the hotel, actually the opposite end of the hotel. Some days after the murder occurred, some bloody gloves were found. These were completely disconnected to the incident in this case, and that they really had no significance in the case. And even the defense expert concurred that Metro had properly stored and preserved the gloves. And what you were left with in this case was the most compelling piece of evidence, obviously, was the fact that the victim's blood was found in the defendant's hotel room. Now, Ms. Dickinson mentioned that there was another source of DNA also found in the hotel room. I don't think it's a shock to anyone in Las Vegas that there are a lot of people in and out of hotel rooms, and the fact that someone else's DNA might be found in a hotel room at the Imperial Palace isn't terribly compelling in terms of a criminal case. There's probably hundreds of people's DNA that could be recovered off the room of that hotel room. The problem for Chow, of course, was Don Idions' blood was in his hotel room, Chow's room, the one he rented, and the body was found one floor below on a balcony which Chao would have had very, very easy access to. This wasn't a case where we had an eyewitness, but certainly the jury had multiple pieces of information which established very clearly and very easily beyond a reasonable doubt both a premeditated murder and a felony murder and the fact that a robbery occurred in conjunction with the crime of murder.
Should we be concerned at all because of the assertion by the defense that exculpatory information was not provided as to the Barber memo and the email?
May I be permitted to answer?
Go ahead and answer.
I just want to make sure I get both of them. It was the Barber memo and the email.
Yes.
With regard to the Barber memo, that actually was provided to the defense. There's some, in the briefing, the court will note, there's some dispute as to when it was actually provided to the defense. They certainly had it before trial, so I don't know how it could qualify as Brady material because they had it pre-trial. In terms of the timing of when it was provided, I don't think the defense could maintain that there was any kind of prejudice to Chao because everyone mentioned in the Barber memo as alternative suspects ultimately testified at trial. So they had the witnesses brought there to be in front of the jury to ask them questions which may have touched on their motivations to harm Mr. Idians or not. All those witnesses testified, so there was really no prejudice. With regard to the email you mentioned, Justice Douglas, that was my recollection is they got that in the middle of trial, and there was no request for a continuance in terms of the questioning or by defense counsel to deal with the email. More importantly, the email itself dealt with an alternative suspect named Wayne Girodi, and he actually testified at the trial, and the email concerned a possible life insurance that he might have had on Mr. Idians, and Mr. Girodi actually testified at trial, yes, I held that policy, here's when it expired. So even the timing on the disclosure of that email, I don't know how conceivably there could have been any prejudice because that information all came before the jury.
Can I answer your question? All right, any colleagues, any other questions? Thanks so much for your presentation. Ms. Dickinson, as I indicated, I'm going to give you 2 minutes in rebuttal.
Your Honor, with regard to the jury instructions and the defense theory of the case, I think it's important to point out that even though Craig denied that he had anything to do with this murder, they also offered a specific jury instruction with regard to involuntary manslaughter, which was rejected by the court. In order to prove the killing was willfully premeditated and deliberate, the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt the defendant did not act in the heat of passion caused by the requisite provocation. So that was also being pursued by the defense. With regard to the state statement that we never objected to the statements coming in, from the extradition hearing or from the detectives. Well, that is accurate only in part, because there was a motion to suppress filed to keep out all the statements from the extradition hearing, which included the statements which came from the police officer, the detectives. However, at trial, when the detectives themselves testified, there was no objection made at that time.
Ms. Dickinson, if I could ask you just a brief question. Hopefully the chief will give you a little bit more time, but on the involuntary manslaughter instruction, if the theory of the defense was, I didn't do it, it wasn't me, how could he ask for an involuntary manslaughter? You'd have to admit that you were involved in you have some theory or some evidence to present that you were involved in the killing and like get together, wouldn't you?
Well, two ways you can ask for it. One, the coroner testified that perhaps maybe only one or two blows actually happened before the death. The others may have happened later. So it did conform with the particular evidence that was presented by the state. Moreover, defense is allowed to offer jury instructions even though it's not the specific theory that they're arguing. I don't have that case in front of me, but we are allowed to do that. I think that it's also important to note that with the cumulative error, there are numerous misstatements in closing. Statements as the evidence, as to when Craig left, statements as to what
testimony was given, and that's all outlined in the brief.
All right. Well, thank you, counsel, for your arguments. Very interesting.